Previously on Beta.
And you honestly look a little bit like a baby.
A little bit.
I'm not only the chef, I'm also a client.
But I'll tell you one thing. I hope you're not going to make a regular thing out of this.
No.
This is a hot dog stand, not a haberdashery.
Hey, not good. We are personal computer police. You cannot say those word crimes. Get in Kanzel.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, director Michael Bonfiglio on the HBO Max documentary, George Carlin's American Dream.
And it was a seminal moment for him because he realized that the people that he was performing for were not the people that he related to, and he didn't want to relate to those people.
Also, Dan Shaun talks about his latest novel, Sleepwalk, which features a lone mercenary of many names.
One of the things I was interested in is taking this isolated guy and bringing the spark of human connection into his life.
But first.
Growing up in America with a Caucasian father and a Korean mother, I relied on my mom for access to our Korean heritage. While she never actually taught me how to cook, Korean people tend to disavow measurements and supply only cryptic instructions along the lines of add sesame oil until it tastes like mom's. She did raise me with a distinctly Korean appetite. This meant a reverence for good food and a predisposition to emotional eating.
That's Michelle Zauner reading an excerpt from her critically acclaimed best-selling memoir, Crying in H Mart. Michelle is not only a literary star, she's a literal rock star. She's the front woman for the alternative pop band, Japanese Breakfast. In her book, Michelle writes poignantly and poetically about her mother's battle with cancer and the complicated relationship with her father. She also shares memories of how her mother passed her love of Korean food onto her and how this helped Michelle stay in touch with her Korean identity. We caught up with Michelle to find out more about her life, career, and to hear the story behind the title of her book.
H Mart is a Korean grocery chain that specializes in mostly East Asian groceries, but especially Korean groceries.
And what makes you cry when you're shopping in an H Mart, if you don't mind my asking?
So my mom was a Korean woman, and she passed away in 2014 from a short battle with cancer. And I found myself going to H Mart after she died as a way to, I think, connect with her memory and this culture that we shared that I was suddenly very afraid of not being a part of or losing in my life. And I think it's just such a intense nostalgic feeling to be in this grocery store with ingredients that remind me of dishes that my mother made or ingredients that she adored and exposed me to. We were particular about everything. Kimchi had to be perfectly sour, samgyeopsal perfectly crisped, stews had to be piping hot or they might as well have been inedible. The concept of prepping meals for the week was a ludicrous affront to our lifestyle. We chased our cravings daily. If we wanted the kimchi stew for 3 weeks straight, we relished it until a new craving emerged. We ate in accordance with the seasons and holidays. When spring arrived and the weather turned, we'd bring our camp stove outdoors and fry up strips of fresh pork belly on the deck. On my birthday, we ate miyeokguk, a hearty seaweed soup full of nutrients that women are encouraged to eat postpartum and that Koreans traditionally eat on their birthdays to celebrate their mothers. But it's also, you know, just seeing people who look a lot like my Korean family that I don't get to see anymore, speaking the language that I don't get to hear so often. And so it just became this kind of place I could go to kind of be surrounded by things that reminded me of my mom and her culture.
What was your relationship with your mother like?
You know, like a lot of mothers and daughters, it was complicated and could be tumultuous, but it was also, you know, endlessly devoted to one another, but constantly sparring, especially in my teenage years. But my mother was a homemaker, and I was an only child. So we were very, very close and very much in each other's lives. And so our relationship was very intense and very intimate, but also, you know, I was fiercely independent, and she was also very, had a real vision for me that wasn't really going according to plan. So we fought quite a bit when I was growing up.
Mm. What was your mother's vision for you?
I think she just wanted me to reach the height of my potential. I mean, she was a very elegant and stylish, sharp woman. And I didn't share the sort of same values that she did. And I desperately wanted to be a musician. I wanted to be a rock star. And I think any mother would maybe be a little bit concerned and feel it was their duty to sort of sway me on another path.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the music career, and you wanted to be a rock star. And to a certain extent, I would say, I don't know how you feel about it, but I would say you are now a rock star with your Japanese breakfast band. But when you were about 16, you started writing and performing music. What did your mother think of you pursuing music as a career?
She was worried. You know, I begged her for guitar lessons when I was 16 or 15, and she would not agree for one or two years because she just felt like, you know, she had paid for piano lessons all these years and I never really gave it any mind. So what would make this any different? And so I think, you know, as a mother, you see your child like kind of phase in and out of a number of hobbies and interests. So I think she thought it was going to be a fleeting passion. And so she was always kind of eager for me to have a backup plan because, you know, It was pretty unreasonable goal in her mind, I think.
Mm-hmm. But as it turned out, it was not so unreasonable. Did you have a backup plan?
I did. I mean, there was a time I didn't really want to go to college, and it was very important to both of my parents that I go to school. And I'm ultimately really glad that I went to Bryn Mawr and you know, received the education that I did. I learned so much in my college years. But for some time, I really was just interested in playing music. So I got my degree and studied creative writing. I thought for some time I might be like a journalist or something. But yeah, I always like worked a job. It was really important that if I was going to pursue music that, you know, I lived the life of a starving artist. So my mom was not, You know, there was no financial help coming from my parents. And, you know, I had to support myself in order to pursue this on the side. So I was always working like restaurant jobs and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Your father's adolescence was even more troubled than your own. How so?
My dad was the youngest of four, and you know, his father was an incredibly physically abusive man who was, you know, I think suffered from PTSD from the war, and his mother left from him when he was born, and so he never knew his father, and his mother was a single working mom of four, and so he didn't have very much supervision as a child. And so he experimented with drugs at a young age and was arrested multiple times, I think, and had a kind of troubled and difficult adolescence.
After your mother passed away, your relationship with your father changed. What happened?
I think that we just had a difficult time grieving together. Our grief just took us over in very different ways, and it was difficult to support and connect with one another for some time. We were also in such different chapters in our lives. You know, my life is in this chapter that was kind of just beginning my adult life in a way. And he was sort of in his like final chapter where he was ready to retire with my mom and enjoy their life that they built together for 30 years. And suddenly, you know, we had to reconstruct what our next chapters were going to be in the wake of her loss. And so I think for me, I just felt like I needed to desperately put my life together and focus on work, you know, both like getting a job and also creative work. And my dad kind of felt this need to sort of pull a new family together in a way and moved very quickly to Thailand and wanted to start dating pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. You write in the book about a trip you and your father took to Vietnam, which where there was a real kind of heavy sort of argument. Can you tell us a bit about that?
It was a weird decision, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think we just both wanted to escape the house. Like the house was just so oppressively put together by my mother, and it was so depressing having to pack up her stuff, you know, day after day. And you know, just like we had just spent like 4 months in that house, like, and then, you know, it was just an oppressive, sad space. So we wanted to take a trip to kind of like connect and bond and kind of get out and escape together. But it's a lot to travel. We went to Vietnam for like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I think. And to be together like every day, like under this great weight of depression and grief, it was just, it was crazy in retrospect that we did that together. And, you know, we were just so sad and so lost and didn't know how to be there for each other and needed so much from one another, was unable to give anything. And, you know, I think kind of took it out on each other and, you know, got irritated with one another and ended up having dinner and sort of, you know, yelling at the other person. And I stormed off and kind of had this sort of surreal moment in Vietnam at just like a bar. I met a girl and we sang karaoke, and you know, it was a nice kind of reflective time when we went there.
Mm-hmm. And you sang, if I'm not mistaken, when you sang karaoke, you sang the Carpenters song, Rainy Days and Mondays.
Yeah, that was my husband and I's first dance song at our wedding.
Nice.
And yeah, so I was just into the Carpenters at the time. And when I sang it, it was just, you know, kind of so fitting, because I think Karen Carpenter is such a tragic character that also radiates like so much joy for other people. You know, there's so much performative joy in the Carpenters, and yet there's sort of this very sad underlying narrative. And I think that was sort of very fitting for how I was feeling at the time, as someone who had to really put on a face of like performative joy and positivity, but was, you know, quietly sort of crumbling on the inside.
Very well said. Your mother used to tell you to save 10% of yourself like she did, but you didn't realize that she had also been keeping 10% of herself from you. I was just fascinated by this passage. What went through your mind when you made the discovery that she was keeping 10% of herself from you?
I mean, I think that there was a feeling of, I mean, obviously I was surprised, but I was also kind of impressed, you know. I think that my mom was like very impressive in that way. She was very private and could be very stoic and withholding and mysterious in this way that I am. My father and I are very similar in this way. We were just open book type of people. Like, I could not really keep a secret to save my life when it comes to my own life. But I mean, I think that's very true of many people, is that like there's this kind of hidden 10% that you keep different 10% from different people in your life. And so part of what was interesting about after she died was like connecting to my dad, or connecting to her sister, or connecting to her friend, and trying to uncover the 10% that they knew of her that I didn't know of her. You know, for instance, like my aunt told me, my aunt kept saying like, oh, I think that she did this because she really missed Korea. Or I think that the reason why she said that was because she really missed Korea and she wanted to come back. And I was always like, I don't think she like was as obsessed with returning to Korea as you think she was. Maybe that's like how you want to feel. But then it kind of dawned on me, like maybe that was just something that my mom never said to us, because she never wanted us to worry about her missing home. But of course she did. And of course she would say that to her sister, who she could confide in, who was there, that she missed home. But she didn't want to reveal that to like my father and I, who would be like, oh, do you want to go back? Like, you know, would make us concerned about that. So that was kind of interesting. And I really value that now. I think that it's a very kind of American concept to be yourself and, you know, be honest all the time. But I think that sometimes withholding information or keeping secrets like from people is actually the stronger and more powerful thing to do. You know, I think it is like to not confide in your child and your husband that you really miss home sometimes because you don't want them to feel like you don't want to be there. That to me is a more generous and loving gesture than being completely honest with your feelings all the time.
Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right. Those are some good words of wisdom. Thank you for those. Is there a particular Japanese breakfast song that you consider to be a tribute to your mother?
I mean, most of Psychopomp, really. Yeah, I mean, In Heaven is very much about that time in my life of just, you know, how difficult it was to be a non-religious person coping with loss. Hecht is a song that's very much about that experience. Rugged Country is a song that's very much about that experience. There are songs on Soft Sounds from Another Planet. Body is a Blade is a song about grief in a lot of ways. So, yeah there definitely. Are many songs that kind of commemorate her.
Yeah. And your mom's on the cover of the Psychopomp album, is she not?
Yes, she is. Yeah, that's her and an old friend when she was probably in her early 20s on the cover of Psychopomp. And then her paintings are also on the vinyl, like, center disc.
What do you think she would have thought of it?
Her general commentary was, I can't understand what you're saying.
Oh, dear.
I think that she didn't feel like I enunciated properly in singing. But, I think she thought it was cute. I think she would be very proud of what I think she would like Japanese Breakfast a lot more than my former bands, because it's a much more, like, pleasant hi-fi sound than it was when I was younger. Mm.
Yeah. Orion Pictures is going to adapt your memoir, Crying in H Mart, into a film. How are you going to be involved?
I'm writing the screenplay and I'm, on as a producer and I'm supervising the soundtrack, I believe. And I finished the first draft and I'm working on the revisions right now.
You mentioned that you're soundtracking the music, so you're not creating it, like you're not creating an original score for it?
I definitely don't want to create an original score. I don't know. I mean, I'm so done with the story that I don't think I need to do every single thing involved with the story anymore. But, I love the idea of Garden State was such a like seminal coming of age film for people of my generation. And that soundtrack was like such a big thing for people that I would love to have my version or like my generation's, the next generation version of that. And putting that together sounds so much more fun to me than like scoring it. I think I will definitely write an original theme for the soundtrack, but I'm more interested in putting the acoustic version of Everlong or some K-pop from the early 2000s or some Shin Jin Hyung songs like that I discovered later on or my friend's band in high school, like stuff like that, I think will be really fun of just like what kind of music I was listening to as an indie kid in the 2000s.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. Michelle Zauner, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Crying in H Mart. It's a beautifully written, very powerful and very poignant memoir. And also congratulations on the film adaptation. We can't wait to see it.
Thank you so much.
Michelle Zauner is the author of Crying in H Mart and the frontwoman of Japanese Breakfast. You can find out more about Michelle at wpr.org/beta.
I think he would be appalled and disappointed, by our lack of caring for one another.
Coming up, director Michael Bonfiglio on the enduring and prophetic legacy of comedian George Carlin. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. George Carlin is one of the greatest stand-up comedians of all time. Unfortunately, George was not only a very funny comedian, he was also very prophetic. That's unfortunate because George made jokes about timely subjects like the environment, big pharma, and police brutality in the 1970s. Michael Bonfiglio is the co-director, along with Judd Apatow, of the HBO Max documentary George Carlin's American Dream. It's a very detailed look inside the mind of Carlin and the ups and downs he faced during his career. Michael joined us to talk about the timeless genius of George Carlin and how he became one of comedy's titans.
As a kid, George was really drawn to very mainstream comedy and entertainment. When he was a child, he looked up to people like Danny Kaye and Bob Hope, but especially Danny Kaye, he always cited as one of his heroes. And so he had this dream very early on as a kid. He really wanted to be a comedic movie star, not a stand-up comic. He sort of saw comedy as a way to that ultimate goal of being a movie star. But clearly it didn't quite work out that way, and I think we're all fortunate that it didn't.
You have some great material from George's older brother, Patrick. Can you tell us about about this?
Yeah, unfortunately, Patrick just passed away about 4 weeks ago. Yeah, we were very fortunate, though, to have him participate in the film and interview him at his home in the Catskills. And Patrick, I think, was, you know, he was older than George by 5 years. He was somebody that George looked up to, and I think he served as a bit of a muse for George.
And he sent me a little manila folder, just a small one, a little bigger than a Christmas card. And he wrote on it in a marker, "For those days when everything has got you down, and when you open it up, there was a photo of my father's gravestone." Isn't that beautiful?
You know, Patrick was not in entertainment. He was a sort of a true New Yorker. The two of them were very close. They really loved each other. And George looked up to Patrick, but also took care of him, you know, financially and in other ways. So it was a very close relationship.
When did George pivot from family-friendly suit and tie comedy to becoming the voice of the counterculture generation?
Well, it was a slow transformation. And I personally find that period of his career so fascinating, because when he first starts out with his partner, Jack Burns, they're a comedy team, Burns and Carlin, and they're kind of, you know, it's 1960, and this is a time that comedy is changing and moving away from the sort of post-vaudevillian kind of comedy to more edgy stuff. People like Lenny Bruce and Mort Saul, The Second City, Compass Players, Nicholson May, what the media termed as sick comics, people like Jonathan Winters as well. Burns and Carlin were finding their way, and a lot of their material is kind of edgy. And George was going back and forth after Burns and Carlin broke up between, he was trying to find his way.
In 1961, John Kennedy brought humor back to the White House, along with a lot of football equipment and a bunch of relatives. Thank you very much. On behalf of the Attorney General, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the members of the Supreme Court, and the rest of my family.
And so always underneath the surface, even in his sort of clean-cut days, there's always this other version of George, the real George, that's bubbling under the surface. So he's struggling all throughout the 60s until he finally, around 1969, 1970, fully transforms into the sort of hippie, long-haired George that became so successful in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm. George's first attempt at changing his comedy happened here in Wisconsin at Lake Geneva. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's not necessarily the first time, but it was one of the first, and certainly one of the most notable, because he was essentially run out of town. Bette Midler, interestingly enough, happened to be opening for him that night. And it was at the Playboy Club in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. And George was playing to a very, you know, what he would call a very square audience. And he began to talk about consumerism and the Vietnam War. And he was basically run off the stage. People were threatening to beat him up. And Playboy at the time and since has this reputation for being very, pro free speech and anti-censorship and things like that. And the Playboy Club and Hugh Hefner and Playboy did not back George at all and kind of left him out to dry. And so he was fired from that. And it was a seminal moment for him, because he realized that the people that he was performing for were not the people that he related to. And he didn't want to relate to those people. So those confrontations helped fuel his decision to change his persona, change his act, and sort of de-transform into who he really felt he was comfortable being as an artist.
Yeah, his true authentic self, so to speak. Yeah, George was a self-described word freak, and he called words his babies. What can you say about his ability to play with words and how he built his comedic voice around that skill?
Yeah, I mean, I think that he saw words. I mean, he was always fascinated by words, and that's one of the things that he's most well known for, is his incredible verbal mastery. You know, I think he saw a lot of hypocrisy in language, double meanings of things, certain things being okay to say, but if it's literally the same word, just in a different order, it has a different meaning, or is therefore something that is not acceptable to say. He really deconstructed language a funny and unique way.
Just take a simple thing like the word alter. Mm-hmm. Alter and change are supposed to mean the same thing. You can alter your plans, you can change your plans, and you've done the same thing. But if you alter your pants and you change your pants...
I just wanted to share a few words with you that amuse me, and combinations of words like occasional irregularity. What other kind can there be? If it were frequent, it would be regularity.
Personally, I feel like it also had something to do with his desire to show that he was intelligent. He dropped out of school in the ninth grade, and I think that he did have a bit of insecurity about that, about his lack of formal education, despite being an absolutely brilliant intellect and extremely well-read and self-educated. Some of his fascination with words perhaps came out of that. I'm not sure. It's just my own personal theory.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. Of course, speaking of words, there's probably what is probably his most famous bit about the seven filthy words you can't say on broadcast. And again, we here in the Dairy State, Milwaukee this time around, played a role in Carlin's arrest. Can you tell us more about this whole incident?
Yeah, it was 1972 Summerfest in Milwaukee, and George was performing a concert. As part of his show, he performed his routine called The Seven Words You Can't Say on Television. And there were police present who objected, and they arrested him. And he was, you know, spent a night in jail, brought into court. And oddly enough, a young assistant DA happened to be at the Summerfest. And what George was arrested for was, it was not an obscenity charge. It was disorderly conduct, profanity.
The next day, the district attorney asked the policeman, and he was questioning me. He says, well, was there disorder? Was he saying this to people? Was he mad? Was he disorderly? Were the people disorderly? And he said, well, he said, so he turned to his assistant district attorney, and he said, well, you were there. What did the audience do? He said, well, they gave him a standing ovation.
I do recall that at some point during the trial, the judge sort of covered his face. He did not want people to see that he was laughing at the routine that was being performed. There was no dispute that he said the words. The issue was, did it tend to cause or provoke a disturbance? And of course, not only did it not, I was there and saw that it did not. So George Carlin was not guilty.
Oddly, the assistant DA served as a witness for George, demonstrating that, you know, and explained to the judge in court that there was no disturbance caused by these words. And so he was let go.
Yeah. Yeah. George did go through a period where he wasn't the counterculture king anymore. He was the butt of jokes from SCTV and Cheech Marin. And Marin even said that George Carlin is obsolete. How did George handle this?
He took it very hard. I think the SCTV parody, which is hilarious, really bothered him.
There's red wine, and there's white wine, but there's no green wine.
There's green grapes,
but no green wine.
For God's sakes, will you just shut up?
SCTV was the smartest, funniest thing in the world.
Yeah.
And these really bright people were seeing the, I guess at that time, tiredness of what George was doing on stage. And he wasn't cutting edge anymore. And he really hated being the butt of jokes. And he really did not like not being the guy who was being celebrated anymore. And I think that that drove his next creative phase. It's not possible for any artist to be on top all the time, you know, and we often talked about him as sort of, you know, like a musician. Even your favorite band, you don't love every single album. And so he was an artist who was constantly trying to push himself and, you know, get better. And there's going to be ups and downs. And I think one of the things that's admirable about George is that he just worked his way through those fallower creative periods and pushed himself to continue to find new things to say and new ways to say them.
Yeah. Your documentary is filled with so many of Carlin's personal letters, diaries, notes, and recordings. You use these with so much emotional power in the film. What was it like to see and or hear these for the first time?
It was really incredible. I mean, George was he was a hoarder, which is a great thing for a subject of a documentary. You know, oftentimes when you're working on something where the person is no longer here to speak for themselves, you know, they haven't left behind quite so much as George did. And so seeing these letters from the early 60s when he and Brenda are on the road and struggling, you know, it's like on his brand new letterhead that he's just had printed up that says, you know, his mother's home address with his name and a logo that were a motto that it said a cross section of modern comedy, George Carlin. It humanized him for us. You know, I never met George. Judd met him once, or excuse me, he interviewed him once and met him a couple of times very, very briefly. I never met him. So, you know, when you're listening to these recordings and seeing his handwriting and his notes to himself and some of these things that felt quite private, it's a connection to the person that's pretty remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. So much of George's work is still cited in our pop culture today. Do you feel that he was just that prescient, or are we as a country that slow to adapt?
I think the fact that so much of what he talked about is still relevant is really disappointing. You know, I mean, when you see him talking about the environment or big pharma or police brutality, you know, in the early 70s, and things really haven't changed at all. And that was one of the things that really drew Judd and I to the project was, here's a comic who, you know, comedy as an art form is generally kind of ephemeral. It's often of its moment, and you don't usually go back decades to find wisdom in comedy. And with George, that's just not the case.
What would you do if you were the planet trying to defend against this pesky, troublesome species? Let's see, what might, viruses. Viruses might be good. They seem vulnerable to viruses. And viruses are tricky, always mutating and forming new strains whenever a vaccine is developed.
The thing that is so key with George is he's not afraid of silence. And so I think when your comedian has a specific agenda, especially one that is so explicitly political and so explicitly like, I'm going to confront the things that you think you don't want me to confront, you have to be able to keep your back stiff. Because if the audience sees you back off, then they got you.
They're all in favor of the unborn. They will do anything for the unborn. But once you're born, you're on your own.
He was talking about issues that are very much still with us, that are fundamental to our culture, to our society, to our humanity. And unfortunately, a lot of it is still extremely relevant.
How do you think George would react to our contemporary times?
Oh, you know, I think he would react very similarly to how he reacted to the times that he lived in. You know, I think he would be appalled and disappointed, you know, by our lack of caring for one another, by our greed, our hypocrisy, our the way that our society is structured to benefit the wealthy and hurt the poor. I think we have our answers as to how he would feel based on the things that he said during his lifetime, because things haven't really changed for the better by and large.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. Very well said. Michael Bonfiglio, thank you for joining us. Congratulations on George Carlin's American Dream. It's a very entertaining and very enlightening documentary.
Thank you so much for having me.
Michael Bonfiglio is the co-director, along with Judd Apatow, of the HBO Max documentary, George Carlin's American Dream. You can find out more about George at wpr.org/beta.
For me, that's the main reason that I enjoy writing, is just discovering these surprises that pop out almost like I didn't write them myself.
Coming up, novelist Dan Shaun joins us to talk about his latest novel, Sleepwalk. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you like to read propulsive psychological suspense fiction, you need to read Dan Shaun's novels and short stories. His work includes the bestseller Ill Will, which Publishers Weekly named one of the 10 best books of 2017. Dan's latest novel is Sleepwalk. Former Beta guest Ruman Alam described Sleepwalk as a frightening indictment of corporate power and the surveillance state, as well as a tender story about the depth of parental love. Ruman is bang on, and Dan does it with a fair share of humor, too. We caught up with Dan to talk about his fourth novel and the challenges that he set for himself.
Yeah, there were a lot of challenges that I wanted to give myself. Most of my other novels are multiple perspective, and I wanted to do a book that was in first person and present tense, and that took place basically in one timeline that lasts about 2 weeks. And all of those things, I think, are kind of invisible to the reader, but they're extremely hard as a writer to pull off. I also knew, having written a really, really dark book, that I wanted to do something that had a little more comedy to it. And I found that in Will's voice. I'm trying to do all the genres. So this is my road novel.
Yeah, definitely. Your protagonist is a man of many names, including Will Bear and The Barely Blur. Can you tell us a bit about him?
Yeah, he's a mercenary, kind of a red shirt who works for a shadowy corporation called Value Standard Enterprises. Nobody really knows what they do, but he goes around the country doing sort of odd criminal jobs for them, whether it's delivering unfortunate people to an unfortunate job or cleaning up after a massacre or burning down a blogger's house. He does a little bit of everything. And then at the beginning of the novel, he starts getting these phone calls from a young woman who claims to be his daughter. And that sets the plot in motion.
Mm-hmm, most definitely. Will spends a fair bit of time thinking about his past, especially his relationship with his mother. Can you tell us about this without revealing any spoilers?
Well, Will was raised by a woman who is a kind of con woman, and he was raised off the grid. She made sure that he didn't have a birth certificate or a social security number or anything that could allow him to be identified or cataloged. She basically raised him as a sidekick that she used during her various schemes. In some ways, I was inspired by the movie and the novel, The Grifters, in that relationship.
Early on in the book, you mentioned this already, I want to dive deeper into it, though. You mentioned that Will is driving along in his camper van with his faithful companion, his dog Flip, when there's this call from this woman. Can you tell us a bit more about the call?
Will is not supposed to be able to be contacted. He has dozens of burner phones under different names. And the first thing that he thinks is that somehow he's been breached and that this person has it in for him, I guess. And he needs to figure out how to find her and kill her because she knows his name and knows where he is. As things go along, he becomes more and more doubtful. And a lot of the suspense of the novel is him trying to figure out if this really is his daughter or not.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, or whether it's just someone trying to scam him or con him. Yeah, so she's this 20-year-old woman, claims to be his biological daughter, and she claims that she's the product of one of his long-ago sperm donations, but Will is suspicious that she has artificial intelligence. So how does this call from this woman who is named Cammy, or at least calls herself that, how does that change his trajectory of his life?
He's been living really on his own and without any real connections. And I feel like one of the things I was interested in is taking this isolated guy and bringing this spark of human connection into his life and seeing how that played out for him. Because despite his criminal ways, there's a tenderheartedness about him. I think we see it even when he's a little boy. There's a kind of innocence and wishfulness and hope of making human connection.
Yes, yes, definitely, yeah. Well, one of the things that I love about your novels and short stories is that so many of your characters have difficulties with their thought processes. That's something that I can really relate to. Why do so many of your characters struggle with self-doubt, or am I just projecting my own self-doubt onto them?
I think it's just part of the emotion that I'm feeling when I'm writing. I don't go to the page feeling confident, partially because I don't really know what's going to happen next, but also partially because that's just sort of one of the ways that I tend to live in the world, is feeling a lot of self-doubt, feeling occasional bouts of self-loathing. And I guess it's easy for me to relate to those characters too.
Yeah. So even you still experience the self-doubt and loathing, even although you've written so many, you know, written four novels and what, three or four short story collections?
I don't know. It never seems to change. It never seems to, I mean, I feel like there's always the possibility that this next book is going to be a huge flop, that everyone is going to hate it, that I'm not even going to be able to finish it. All of those things are, they wind around and it doesn't seem to get better with time. So I'm still getting older. So maybe next book or the book after.
So Sleepwalk is set in the near future, but you took kind of a subtle approach to the futuristic technology in the book. What did you decide to include and why?
It was a kind of practical decision. And I think a lot of writers are struggling right now with how to write about the contemporary experience because things are changing so rapidly. You know, like by the time your book is finally published, it's going to be 2 or 3 years down the line. And if you think about what things were like even 2 or 3 years ago, we've seen so many radical and crazy changes in our lives just in over a period of a couple years. So I tried to add things that I thought were possible or likely. This is a future where we're, you know, maybe one more pandemic down the line, or one more environmental crisis down the line, or one more constitutional crisis down the line. And most of the stuff either has been or very shortly will be reality. And so there are drones that are surveillance drones. That's not out of the question. There's security drones. There's some robots that walk along the side of the road and advertise stuff. There's some stuff with cloning and DNA and genetics that is mostly possible. Some stuff is a little bit outside of what we can actually do. But, you know, I wrote about using animals to grow organs, and that was not happening at the time, but I mean, it is now.
Getting back to this idea of self-doubt that you have about writing, I've read that as you have gotten older, you've started trusting your unconscious mind more and more. How does this increasing trust affect the way you write?
I don't write with an outline. I feel like it makes me more open to being surprised by things and to letting the characters sort of discover things that I would not necessarily have written had I, you know, had an outline and had it all sort of figured out beforehand. For me, that's the main reason that I enjoy writing, is just discovering these surprises that pop out almost like I didn't write them myself. Despite the self-doubt and self-loathing or whatever, that's a good feeling. And that, I mean, it's really exciting, and it really just delights me when something like that happens.
Yeah. And if you didn't have that voyage of discovery, which you have from not using an outline, I get the impression, and from what I've read about a lot of writers, and I think it would apply to you, but I want to ask, is that if you outlined the whole novel, then yeah, where would be the fun and the joy of discovery in writing it? You'd be less motivated to write it, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. It would just feel so predetermined. I think there'd be something kind of dull about it. Part of the process of and this may sound too mystical or whatever, but letting the character develop and come alive, there's a point where they are actually outside of you, that where they're making their own decisions. There's a sense that maybe you thought something was going to happen, but then you realize, oh no, Will wouldn't do that. That's not the type of person he is. And you wouldn't have discovered that unless you had been sort of letting him unfold on his own in this weird way.
Yeah, very well said. You've said that all of your novels have been puzzles that you've created for yourself. And as you just said a few moments ago, you don't work from an outline, but instead you work with what you describe jigsaw pieces. How do you go about putting these jigsaw pieces together?
I do write with a particular genre in mind. And a genre is always a kind of container that gives you a framework to work with. So in some ways, I've got these pieces, these individual pieces, usually scenes or moments that the character experienced that may seem disconnected. But I know that once I fit them in, they're going to be pieces that in some ways are going to be necessary to replicate the structure of the genre. In this case, the road novel and the noir. You know, I know that there's going to be at least a few scenes where he has to talk to people about his past, where there's going to be this kind of mystery that's going to be explored over the course of the book. Then I begin to plug things in so that they follow that pattern.
Hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Near the end of Sleepwalk, there's this great sentence that really captures what it's like to live in 2022. I just want to share it with you and get your take on it. Quote, "It was disconcerting to live in a time in which accepting reality required a suspension of disbelief," unquote. How does this apply to the way you're living your own life these days?
Yeah, I guess I live my life in part in denial a lot, and maybe a lot of people do. There's that meme with the dog drinking coffee in a burning
yes.
coffee shop, and the dog is thinking, this is fine. And I feel
yes.
like in some ways that's all of us right now. You know, we're looking at terrible things barreling towards us, and there's this helplessness that I think a lot of people feel. I guess the novel in some ways is a reaction to that feeling of helplessness and to that sort of blasé attitude that we have to take on to get through our daily lives and wash the dishes and feed the dogs and make dinner. But I also wanted it to be a story where somebody takes action and changes things, at least slightly for the better.
Mm. Yeah, and you've done that. And also there's a fair bit of humor in the book too.
I hope so. I really wanted it to be a funny book. I mean, I realize that it's also murdery and has like lots of dark elements, but I thought of it as funny in kind of the way the Coen brothers are funny.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, it has kind of a Coen brothers-esque vibe to it. You're absolutely right. Because, yeah, there's a lot of funny things that Will says and a lot of funny interactions he has. In the acknowledgments, you mentioned your friend, the great cartoonist Linda Barry, and you say that she walked you through the writing of this book, and if not for her advice, Sleepwalk wouldn't exist. How did Linda help?
We used to have writing sessions together, and I would just read things that I had written. Sometimes we'd just sit down together and write on a timer for 15 minutes or something like that. That was extremely helpful to me, really helped in the process of discovery. I mean, if you think about writing, just free writing for 15 minutes a day for a year, there's so much material that comes out of it. And some of it, I of course, never got to use, but it was really a great experience.
Mm. You and I have the same all-time favorite film, Alfred Hitchcock's 1958 film Vertigo. I'm just curious, whenever there's a chance to ask a question about Vertigo, I always ask it. And I wanted to ask you, has Vertigo been an influence on your fiction in any way?
It has such a deep and abiding influence on, I think, almost all my novels and short stories, because it's so much about identity and about what's real and what's not, about whether other people are knowable. And it's also about gaslighting. And I think all of those things are major themes in my books.
Mm, yeah, you're right. Can you tell us what genre you're going to tackle in your next novel?
Yes, it's the Western. I'm doing a dark Western that takes place in the Midwest in a traveling carnival. I mean, there's this huge history of those traveling carnivals that went around the Midwest. And I'm going back to Nebraska, South Dakota, Wyoming, Colorado, the places that where I grew up, and kind of revisiting those. I grew up in this very small town in Nebraska. It was about 20 people. And in some weird ways, I had a very asynchronic childhood. I mean, it was in the 70s and 80s, but I mean, there were still people that didn't have running water in their houses. There were still people that used outhouses. There were still like the old sod houses left in the middle of a field where people had once settled and lived in a house made of sod and rock. So that time period really still speaks to me, I guess.
Dan Shaun, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Sleepwalk. I can't wait to read your next book, The Western Noir, so please get it finished ASAP. No pressure, though.
I will do so. Thanks, Doug, for having me on.
Dan Shaun's latest novel is called Sleepwalk. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Michelle Zauner, Michael Bonfiglio, and Dan Shaun. If you want to hear it again or catch up on past episodes, click over to Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast catcher and click subscribe, follow, and like. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
I say to myself, I'm going to make these people pay.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
So I dislike and despise groups of people, but I love individuals.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
I'm here for me, you're here for me, and no one's here for you.